Well, what I'll be talking about is the Great Depression of the 1930s. That's the period in which I got my start in folklore and collecting. They called it in those days the root hog or die days, and that's exactly what it was, and I do hope none of you will live to see it again if any of you here were there back then. I'm not at all sure that it's not that we ever solved the Depression except by starting hot and cold wars and putting our generations into hock. But anyway, here's hoping it won't happen again. Things were very, very bad back then. My father was a retail merchant in Jacksonville, and it was selling furniture at a dollar down, a dollar a week. And my job after school and weekends was to go try to collect those dollar bills. And I got an inside look into both the white and black poor folks, and almost everybody was poor in those days. I recall one black mother. She said, if I give you this dollar, she said, my children have to go to bed hungry tonight. So there I was, a teenager, hearing this kind of thing, you know. And it's enough to make even a teenager do some thinking as whether to take that dollar or not take it. And other furniture merchants would say my father's too good a man, a Christian, to be in the furniture business, because he would let them keep the furniture if he was convinced they didn't have a job and didn't have the money, that he would let the furniture stay there. On the other hand, he told me that if they see them drinking beer and don't want to give you the dollar bill, then send for the truck and we'll come pick up the furniture. So, and the stores retained title to the furniture, so they didn't need a warrant, didn't need anything, just back up the truck and walk in and get it. So sometimes the food would be cooking on the stove and the couple in the bed, and we just haul them both off hot. like that. I remember one of the little songs I heard back then was says, if there was a devil born in the land, it must have been the furniture man. That's, I guess, where that comes from. One of the other collectors was trying to show me how to do things, and he also had a side job collecting on clothing, dollar down clothing stores. So he sees this black fellow coming down the sidewalk, and so he reaches under his coat and pulls out a .45 and sticks it in his stomach. He says, take it off. So the guy in broad daylight starts taking off the suit and hands him the suit, and walks on off down the sidewalk in his undershort. And that's the way it was back then.
Could you tell us a little bit about your days in Key West and also working with Zora Neale Hurston and Alan Lomax?
Well, I went to the University of Florida eventually after I got out of Robert E. Lee High School in Jacksonville. And I soon came to the conclusion that I wasn't doing the university much good and they weren't doing me much good. And so I sort of, you might say, invented independent studies by dropping out. And I dropped out and shipped a trunkload of books to Key West by water, the cheapest way, and hitchhiked after them, and spent quite a long time in Key West. And Key West was so hard up, they couldn't pay the fire, garbage, police, any city employees, so the city had a meeting in Papers Cafe and passed a resolution to give itself to the state of Florida. They couldn't pay their bills. So Key West gave itself to the state of Florida. The state of Florida promptly gave it to the United States government. So it's the first and only time in American history, anyway, where the federal government owned and operated a city. And they sent in a dictator, you might say. And he ran around in one of those African, you know, cork helmets and shorts. And he had us all planting coconuts along the boulevard. He said, maybe if we get some coconuts growing along the boulevard, the Yankee tourists will come on down from Miami to see how pretty coconut drive. And of course that happened, and I think everybody in Key West regrets planting those coconuts because the rich folks have bought them out, and they've had to move up to Ocala and such places away from the ocean and so on. The places they love so much, including the cemeteries, they just taxed them out of existence. They couldn't continue to live in the homes that they were born into. So it was that kind of a sad story. I remember already while I was in Key West, I was doing some recording, and there's a Bahaman black there named Theodore Roll, and they called him T-Roll. And he was singing all these songs in the AME church. And Alan Lomax and his father John had already sort of preempted the folklore field by collecting all the John Henry songs and things like that. So I said to myself, how can I, age 19 or 20 at the time, how can I make myself a career in folklore? So I had the idea, I'll just collect all the dirty songs. So when I got the T-Roll, I said, you know any dirty songs? And he said, I know plenty. He said, but I'm not going to sing them here in this, with all these women in the audience. So I said, okay, we'll be back here at 8 o'clock in the morning and we'll do dirty songs and no women. So I showed up at 8 the next morning, and the women's heads sticking in all the downstairs windows. They had ushers barring them at the door, but they had their heads in the windows. But T-Roll sang anyway. What else you want to know about? Zora Neale Hurston came on board. I joined the Writers Project, WPA Writers Project, in 1937, and Zora came on board the following year. And we had to sign what's called a pauper's oath in order to get a WPA job. And you had to swear that you had no money and no job and no property and no prospect of getting any of that stuff. So I was eminently qualified and got the job. And the job title was Junior Interviewer. And the pay was $37.50 every 2 weeks. So the following year, Zora Hurston came along. She'd already had two books published. But she wanted one of those jobs too. And she took the pauper's oath. And I think they paid her $5 less every 2 weeks than they paid me, because she lived in Eatonville, where it's supposed to cost less to live than it did in Jacksonville. So she got $5 less than that. But I was supposed to be her boss, and she's not an easy one to boss, I'll tell you.
Did you ever go out on interviews with her? Or
about what?
Did you ever go out on interviews with her?
Yes, we're talking about 1938 and thereabouts, and mixed couples, much less, racially mixed and much less sexually mixed. Black and white, male, female. There weren't many places in Florida you could go. And she had, in fact, there were so few places where Afro-Floridians could sleep, no motels, no restaurants and so on, and she had to just sleep in her car, she had a beat up Chevy. And so I had the idea of even before that, I'll speak to your question in a moment. I had the bright idea, said, why spend all this gas money running around the state of Florida collecting folklore? The gas costs, like 12 cents a gallon. So I said, we'll save that 12 cent gas money and get Zora up here and put her down in a chair and pick her brain so that we get everything for free that she knows about Florida folklore. So that's what we did. So we got Zora seated in the chair, and after again following my policy of looking for dirty songs after they ran out of other things, I asked her if she knew a song, Uncle Bud. And she said, yeah, she knew it. And I said, what kind of song would you call it, Uncle Bud? She said, said, "Oh, that's one of those juke songs." And I said, "What do you mean juke song?" He said, "Well, a juke song is a song you wouldn't sing in front of anybody but a juke woman." And I said, "You heard it?" "Yeah, I heard it." So I said, "Well, sing it for us." And she sang it. You can get the thing on tape from Tallahassee, the Folklife Archive. You can get the unexpurgated version with all the four-letter words, or if you ask for it. Or you can get one they doctored up to play over here some while back. But incidentally, all the stuff that we collected back then is in Tallahassee, and those of you that have programs and our teachers can get the cassettes at cost. And I commend it to those, including those who are practicing folk musicians. Oh, there's an awful lot of Florida roots over there on tape. And I remember one time back then in the 40s, Harry Belafonte was just starting out. And we were riding in the same car and from a lecture thing. And he didn't, all he knew was sing pop songs he'd heard on the radio. So I said, "Harry, why don't you go down to the Library of Congress in the Archive of American Folk Songs and look into that stuff and, you know, get you something special on that stuff and not just radio pop songs." And that's what he did, and that's where he picked up his island roots and been going strong ever since.
Well, Stetson, I'd like to ask you about a couple of literary icons that you had a lot of contact with. Marjorie Rawlings is one, and Woody Guthrie is another one that you were closely associated with. What was it like working with Marjorie Rawlings?
Marjorie, I got to know when she first came to Florida. I had a neighbor in Jacksonville, and she spent some time living there, actually, before she ever found Cross Creek. And I remember I was still a boy in high school, and I remember having her omelets. She was cooking, and she cooked a very good omelet.
Can't hear.
Your mic is off, I said.
I don't know.
Just change mics, bring it over.
So the question was about Marjorie Rawlings. And the fact that as a boy in Jacksonville, she came to town before she ever found Cross Creek and was staying next door. And I had a chance to sample her omelets, and they were very good omelets. And I was struck by how piercing her eyes were. You know, I had a feeling she was seeing through everything us boys were up to. And I sort of decided right then that maybe that's what a good writer needed to be, is sharp-eyed. And see through things. And later on, in later years, someone said, "I understand you took a course in creative writing under Marjorie Rawlings." I said, "No, not me." And they said, "Oh yeah, you did." I said, "I saw the record." So I said, "No, I never took any course under Marjorie Rawlings." So I met him again later, and he had the record in his hand, you know, where I'd passed the course. And I'm sure it did me a lot of good, but I didn't remember it. I think we're doubly blessed here in Florida to have a Marjorie Rawlings to perpetuate our white culture on the one hand, and Zora Neale Hurston on the other hand to perpetuate our Afro-Floridian culture. It's not many states had a pair like that. And every people on the face of the earth better wish they had such coverage.
What about Woody Guthrie?
Woody and I go way back. When my first book, Palmetto Country, came out in 1942, Erskine Caldwell had discovered me, so to speak, and invited me to write that Folkways book, which he edited a whole series of regional books. And when it came out, Alan Lomax passed it on to Woody in New York, where they both lived at the time. And so I got this fan letter back from Woody saying how much he liked the book and how it gave him a better feel for Florida than a lot of the other 47 states. We didn't have but 48 then. He said already tramped and boot the other 47, but my book gave him a better feel for Florida than he had all those others where he'd actually been. And you ended up the letter by saying, don't be surprised if somebody come staggering up to your front door with my guitar and we'll have a good long talk. It didn't happen quite that way. I got a call from the Greyhound bus station in Jacksonville and asked me to come pick him up. And I get there and he's sprawled out on the sidewalk in broad daylight and sound asleep with his head resting on his guitar case. So and the people stepping over him didn't know whether he was drunk or dead or what he was, you know. But and especially the Afro Persian was admiring the ability of this white man to just take a nap on the sidewalk. So I said, Woody, where's your baggage? And he started unbuttoning. And he's wearing 5 shirts. And that's all the baggage he had. So he slept in a hammock at my place there, halfway between St. Augustine and Jacksonville. Incidentally, we're planning to turn that into a folk culture retreat devoted to not only folk culture, but to environmental heritage and human rights. So it'll be a three-way street, I hope, and attracting people who want to come there and look at Woody's the things Woody composed there and sang there and recorded there. And we're just now starting that and hope to see a lot of you up there someday.
We were recently talking to Stetson. The Folklife program is over in the Bureau of Historic Preservation, and we've been looking at the possibility of putting Beloothehatchee on the National Register. And in the process, we had some interesting conversations about what happened to your property after you wrote The Klan Unmasked. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your research for the book and then what happened.
Yeah, that's something of a footnote to the Woody story. He was there. He came frequently and stayed a long time and actually wrote the final draft of his autobiographical Seeds of Man book there. And he wrote a ballad called Beloothehatchee Bill about me and my Klan busting. My first name was William. I didn't know it till I grew up. But anyway, Woody was there, and the Klan was always after us. And the FBI had helicopters. Anytime Woody came to town, they sent a helicopter to keep watch on the place. And one night, we all had a gun, and Woody didn't have one. And, you know, preparing for the Klan to show up. But there was a World War I rifle hanging on the wall, and he went into Jacksonville and got some ammo custom made for it and would practice shooting wine jugs, 1 gallon wine jugs, and he got real good at it. And so one night I said, well, let's have a little mock Klan raid, but don't tell Woody. So Woody was, you know, the legend says that Woody always slept with his boots on. And I can tell you there's some truth in that, because it was something of a necessity in the hobo jungle, and the railroad cops coming up swinging their sticks. You had to be ready to run and no time to put on your shoes. So Woody kind of got in that habit. But he slept in a hammock at my place, and on this night he slept with his boots off. And so we all jumped out and started shooting. The hammock had a mosquito net all around the side and a rubber roof over the top. So he didn't wait to unzip the hammock. He just came out through the mosquito net and grabbed his gun, and we all had a live oak tree as our battle station. So, but on the way to his station, he stepped in the hot campfire coals and didn't have his boots on, so I felt pretty guilty about my... Yeah, that's the way it was. I'd like to just say a word, you know, how gratifying it is to be here on the 51st occasion of this festival, and how important I think these festivals have been to the state of Florida. I'm sure you all know that the festival was endangered and sort of canceled a little while back, and everybody set up such a howl that they reinstated it. I think we all owe the Florida State Park Service a vote of thanks for having resurrected it. and who want to keep it that way. And you know, they tax us for everything on Earth, including all kinds of wars, good and bad. And seems to me, always has seemed to me, that you know, physical health, they don't mind spending tax dollars on health care and medical, mental health. But I've always thought that cultural health was just as important as the physical and the mentals. That any people that doesn't have a live, kicking culture is in trouble. And if they don't look to their past, they're not going to have much of a present or a future. And it's just as important. You can't live by bread alone. You got to have this kind of thing to make life worth living. Zora had probably the world's best definition. She said, folklore is the boiled down juice or pot liquor of human living. And I think that couldn't be said better. And so it's something that we want to keep the torch high and pass it on.
Could you tell us a little bit, Stetson, about what it was like when you went undercover in the Ku Klux Klan back?
I'm sorry.
Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like when you went undercover in the Ku Klux Klan? We've got a few more minutes.
Yeah, let me ask you this. Yeah. Did you realize that the danger you were putting yourself in?
I'm pretty. It might be have to be a damn fool not to. It's all a damn fool to do it anyhow, you know. And, it was during World War II, and all my classmates were overseas, you know, fighting racism. They didn't know quite what they were fighting, but that's what they were doing. And they were getting shot at in a big way, and there the Klan was in their own backyard and doing the same kind of thing as the Nazis. So I decided, you know, what was needed was some real hard evidence that could be taken into a court of law, and the only way to get it was infiltration. And it worked beautifully, because as soon as they knew I was in there, somebody was in there, because I was broadcasting it. I broadcast the minutes of the Klan's last meeting every Sunday, coast to coast on the radio. So with all the names, you know, and the passwords and stuff. So those people, the judges and the cops and everybody, politicians who were there, never came back. And attendance hit rock bottom, and recruitment hit rock bottom, and the best of all, the violence. They were afraid to make a move. So it's, I think, a lesson for today to our intelligence community, that if they're really serious about fighting terrorism, they better get inside and do an inside job on them.
At one point, the Klan didn't. You were. I think you had mentioned you were gone from Beloothahatchee, and the Klan came out to your house.
Oh yes, there was an occasion. The Klan. I had a fence around some 50 acres, and then they had taken a torch and waited for the favorable wind that would take the power through the brush to the house. So when that wind came, they took a torch and walked along the outside of the fence and just set a brush fire the full length of the fence. And it was, I think Woody was there on that occasion, and some of our black neighbors came running. And we kept tubs full of water for just such an occasion, and cut young saplings and dip them in the tub of water and knock out the fire. So we barely managed to save the house, yeah.
Right. Didn't they also tear out your orange groves?
Orange grove, there was a small grove, and when I went overseas in 1952 and came back 8 years later, I only had a one-way ticket, and it took me a while to get back. And I spent it over there looking at folklore and what the various other peoples and societies were doing about their folk culture and so on. And it was 8 years well spent, I think. But when I got back, it's true, the orange grove, the Klan had burned up the dwelling and dug up the orange trees, and had used my home site as a rifle range. They put the targets on a beautiful live oak and fill that live oak full of so much lead that the tree died.
Somebody had your picture up there.
I'd forgotten that. That's what the neighbors said. Yeah.
I believe when you were over there in Paris for a while, you were, you were hanging around with people like Jean-Paul Sartre and.
Overseas, y'all, I had written my book called Jim Crow Guide, and it is the only collection of all the Jim Crow laws and regulations in existence. And you can find it on my website, in fact, because in those days I could not find an American publisher for either the Jim Crow book or the Klan book. So when I got to Paris, someone took me to see Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, playwright, and he published it in French. And it went on from there into about 20 other languages around the world, but not in America. And it was not until almost a half century later that I was able to get the University Press in Florida to publish those books that I wrote back 50 years ago. So they're now all available. They're not only available at Gainesville, but they're available at the media booth over here. I'll be signing some over there if any of you are interested in getting copies.
Also, like I say, he's going to be down at the River Gazebo about 12:30, something like that. And we may talk for just briefly down there, but we'll recognize him for sure.
Right.
And they're going to be talking about him on the main stage over here tonight. I'm sure that they're going to recognize him. And I want to say, Stetson, you are truly my hero.
Well, thank you. I forgot to mention that Frank also wrote a ballad about me, not just Woody, but Frank Thomas, and he said he's going to be singing that thing tonight.
What is his website?
Your website.
Your website.
That's it, y'all.
Okay, www.stetsonkennedy.org
or.com
for Stetson's website. And thank you so much, Stetson. We're really honored that he's here with us at the festival this year.
How long is that? How long is that?